From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood, a community that has served as an Ellis Island of sorts for immigrants from Central America and the Caribbean and for Cuban Americans. Despite its long history as a cultural centerpiece and its unique architectural styles, the area stands to see significant change related to development. According to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, Little Havana's historic buildings could be demolished, residents could be displaced, and zoning changes could impact its cultural richness and character. The threats are related to density. On one side of the issue, developers say new units are needed to accommodate the growing population. Historic preservationists say building out vacant lots and vacant buildings could accomplish the same goal while preserving Little Havana's historic structures. The neighborhood is just one example of a historic community facing development pressures. As more people move to urban centers, there's an increased need for housing. What does that housing look like, especially in historic communities? And meanwhile, historic towns facing depopulation, places like Cairo, Illinois, have the opposite problem. Economic challenges make rehabbing historic spaces a challenge. So what does this mean for the field of historic preservation? In a recent piece for CityLab, preservationist Patrice Fry argues that the historic preservation landscape is changing, and the preservationists must change with it. That leads to several questions. How do communities decide which buildings to keep, and why? How should the toolbox of preservationists change to help them make better informed decisions and share the full stories of communities, especially those that are traditionally underrepresented? Our guest for the hour will weigh in on whether preservationists need a new approach, as CityLab suggests in their headline. Joining us in studio, Wayne Goodman, Executive Director of the Landmark Society of Western New York. Wayne, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Larry Francis, Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society. Welcome to you.
Great being here.
Hello to Glenn Kellogg, Principal of Urban Advisors and owner of Hart's Local Grocers. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And with us is Drew Costanza, developer with Costanza Enterprises. Welcome, Drew.
Thank you very much, Evan.
All right, Wayne. So it turns out you need a new approach. We were kind of joking. It was a pretty kind of a bombastic headline, but you said before the hour there's some things they get right there.
I think they get a lot right, actually, in the article. I don't disagree that preservation has needed a new approach for a while. I think the Landmark Society here in Rochester and Western New York, over the past particularly 6 to maybe 8 years, has been trying to, I think, become more contemporary in our approach. So the other thing to mention is just preservation as a field has been an evolving field for a long, long time. I mean, preservation back, for instance, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, primarily was concerned with preserving old houses out of context and being used as house museums. So they were fairly static monuments. And obviously that's evolved quite a bit. So we need to keep evolving. I think it's important.
Okay, Larry?
Well, I agree that that a lot of people look at preservation and look at preservationists as, you know, building huggers, and that it's all about just saving old buildings. But I think there's a lot of education. I mean, we really do need to let people know that preservation is about economic development. Preservation is about community building and neighborhood building. And we look at a building now and see what it can be, and not keeping it what it was.
Glenn Kellogg, I want to talk a little bit about density, because you've done work in a number of cities across the country, and density means different things in different places, especially with population trends that are maybe different in Rochester than they are from Manhattan to D.C. to elsewhere. And the UN, everything from the UN to the Green New Deal, talks about the fact that people are moving more toward cities and probably need to for a lot of different reasons. How do you see density as an issue when it comes to preservation and trying to set standards for what we do and don't do?
I think that's a really interesting point that you started with, that different communities are facing different pressures. And there are places like Little Havana where you've got the preservation against growth sort of conflict, in places that you don't really have that same conversation in Buffalo and Rochester. You have a different conversation in Buffalo and Rochester than you do in New York City and in Boston and in Miami, where things are going crazy, right? And so I think there's two sides with legitimate arguments. I think one of the things that helps calm the waters is just having really clear guidelines that in preservation districts, the developers know what the rules are, that and that there aren't a lot of exceptions. These are the rules for what the community has decided we want for preservation in these areas. And if you're going to be developing in these areas, these are the rules. I think that helps a lot. It helps make it safer for developers coming in, that they know what to expect. They're not walking into a minefield of community outrage and a uncertain approvals process. So I think that having that nailed down, it's amazingly uncommon for approvals to be administrative that way.
Drew, is there a sense that developers, do I have this picture in my mind of developers thinking of preservationists as, you know, hippies standing in front of bulldozers? Is that is that what you think of the preservation community?
Well, as Wayne knows, that's how I used to think of it before he came to town from Indianapolis.
See, it's true. Oh, so that cartoonish view, you really did think of them that way.
I set the slide, Drew, a 50.
Just kidding, Wayne. No, I think that's a little bit outdated and definitely exaggerated. But yes, there's a certain core truth to the premise that many developers over the years, over the decades, have run into huge obstacles in trying to renovate certain buildings, whether it's a house on East Avenue, a building downtown, what have you. But I think it's changed dramatically. I know here in Rochester, it's changed dramatically because of Wayne's leadership and change in direction. And in fact, that's what spurred my interest in the organization 5, 6, 7 years ago on a 3-year stint on the board. I think what I took out of that article, Evan, and what I would stress, I absolutely agree that we do have to have rules, and that's, you know, that's the American way. But within any set of rules, I think there has to be built in, especially if you want the maximum benefit to society, to the community, there has to be flexibility built in. That's, for example, why we have variances. I'll give you an example here in Rochester. Our first big foray was the Temple Building back around 99. It had for years and decades been a Class B office building, and that market had just disintegrated in 10 years. And we were faced with a real problem. We were down to less than 50% occupancy. Didn't know what to do with the building. And it sort of came to us from seeing the Loftus brothers doing a development on the west side of the river 3 years earlier. Why not put in loft apartments? Well, it sounds great, but one of the first things we realized was without parking, underground parking, it probably wouldn't work. So very quickly we realized from working with our architects and engineers that, you know, there's all sorts of rules for a parking garage, especially an underground one. What allowed our building to go through, and now it's completely rented, 100%, first time in about 30 years, is we were able to obtain about a dozen separate variances from the city of Rochester and the state of New York, because this was a 1926 building. It had a 1926 basement that was meant to be the basement for a church, not for a modern parking lot. By being flexible with the variances built in and getting those variances, we went ahead with a $7 million project that ultimately, I think somewhat kicked off a boom, at least on the east side of the river, with loft apartments. So everything is fine in terms of rules. You do have to have those. But within those rules, if there's a maximum amount of flexibility, it just point blank allows more development to occur, which again is to everybody's benefit.
All right, so listeners, as we talk about preservation this hour, we'll direct you again if you want to read the City Lab piece, and we always love their work. We'll post it on our various platforms here. When it comes to the author of the piece, she writes that there should be just a general guideline. Buildings are historically significant or they are not. Yes, Larry?
No, I don't think so.
More nuanced than that?
Yeah,
this is where
absolutely.
You have some disagreement?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the problem has to do with, I don't want to say the problem, but some of the concerns have to do with the Secretary of the Interior standards. I mean, they're 1977 standards. And when we're talking about historic tax credits, which, often are one of the elements that make a project really work, you're dealing with these pretty stringent standards. And I think depending on the importance of the building, they can vary, absolutely. But it's not a matter of it's either historic or it isn't.
Okay, Wayne?
No, well, first, I don't agree that a building should either be historic or non-historic. And I guess I just share the view probably with everyone here that, you know, our world's not really a binary world. There's a lot of gray area. So I wouldn't agree with that. I think that I think you mentioned a point earlier, Evan, about this idea of myth and sort of what preservation stands for. And I think it needs to be, I think we need to do a better job as preservationists of carrying the message through that as we have been evolving our philosophy over the past 6-7 decades, we need to really carry the message that preservation at its core, of course, is historic architecture. So we're preserving a historic design, historic materials and craftsmanship. But it's also about rejuvenating small towns, rural areas that are struggling. It's about affordable housing. It's about creating walkable, livable communities, providing city amenities, job creation. It's all of that. So it gets really complex. And oftentimes, I think that there's an overriding myth that preservationists are just simply focused on the historic structure. And while that's certainly at its core, it's not exclusive to that interest, I don't think.
There's a couple of points in the City Lab piece that really I want to press next with our guests here. And they look at how things are changing and how things are actually not changing as much as we thought. You go back 20 years ago, and a lot of people were saying, well, newspapers are going to be gone in 5 years. Turned out it took 20 years. No, newspapers aren't gone yet. Sorry to our colleagues in the industry. We want newspapers to be here forever. But, yeah, there was a lot of prognostication in 1996, 7, 1998. Newspapers are going to be gone in 5 years. That didn't happen. You also had, and this is noted in the City Lab piece, this idea that futurists and technologists 20 years ago were saying that place would become irrelevant, that we would live, work, and connect with the world almost exclusively online. We would work, everyone would work from their home space, that don't bother redesigning your downtown office space because you won't need it anymore. When you hire people who, you know, 20 years ago, people were saying that, hey, today's, you know, middle school students or today's, you know, infants are going to be graduating and wanting to work. They're not going to want to go work for a law firm with an office downtown. They're going to want to work remotely. They're not going to want to go work anywhere but in their own sort of design spaces. We're not quite there. I mean, certainly some trends are changing with where we work and people want to work more remotely. But for futurists and technologists who said that place would become irrelevant, I mean, Glenn Kellogg, place is not irrelevant.
I think they got that exactly wrong. That those changes actually made place more relevant because...
Well, that's an interesting idea.
That as soon as you're not tied to where you have to be, you can be where you want to be. And downtowns with historic buildings and walkable main streets are where everyone wants to be. Asterisk on that. It's not where everyone wants to live, but they're very popular places.
Yeah, what an interesting point. It made it more important. But is there, if you go back to those futurists and technologists who were making that point, are they making any sort of a point that's salient to you, Glenn, about the changing customs with how we expect to work, at least in workspaces?
I don't think I quite... you're thinking about whether we're going back to downtown work environments. I'm not really sure, but I think if you look at small startup tech companies and where they want to be, they like being in old, cool loft spaces in downtowns. They don't really want to be out in the suburbs. They want to be close to the coffee shop. They want to be close to amenities, and that's what downtowns are.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't say that they're interested in the Class A office space where their fathers were lawyers in a really boring building. I think that's kind of dying.
Wayne, what would you say to those futurists and technologists about the place is going to be irrelevant?
I think that's a great point that Glenn made. I can't say it any better than what Glenn just articulated that. I think that as technology expands, I think that human nature at its core is that we're social creatures. And even though we may work in a cocoon or we can have our own designed space at our home or remote office, however one tends to work, I think most people, I don't have any data to back this up, but I think most people are social creatures, even if it's shooting ideas off of colleagues or overhearing conversation that might really start a new idea, spawn creativity. I think it's important to be around other people. And I think that's what Glenn's talking about. When you go into any community, it seems, whether they're large communities or smaller communities, downtowns often become the de facto billboard of the community, certainly the city center, the core of the city. I remember one time when I was a young child, we were on vacation. We were driving on the East Coast. We went through Boston, but we went on the outskirts of Boston. And I asked my dad, who was driving the car, I said, "Can we go into Boston?" He said, "We're in Boston." And I said, "Well, not really. We're not like really in Boston." It's just that I think the image of downtown and the core and the message that carries for your entire region and community, I think is important.
Okay, Larry?
I think the popularity, the growing popularity of our small villages and towns really tell us what people want. And when we look at our Genevas and we look at our Perrys, and we realize that young people are coming back to these areas and they can afford to start their own businesses, and tourists are coming to these areas and they are experiencing the new restaurants and the new shops. I think that really brings out the point of what people want. I mean, before I moved here, I lived in a tiny town of 1,450 people and had a gift shop, and everybody was saying, "Oh, you know, it's all going to go online. You have to get online. You have to do everything online." Well, we made candies and desserts, and you can't taste and you can't smell candy being made and...
Just wait. But not yet.
No, but there's something about that, you know, person-to-person experience. Yep. When you would walk into our gift shop, there was something about it. There was a smell. There was a feel. There was a personal connection. And that's what people want. They want a personal connection.
Okay. Well, I want Drew Costanza to weigh in on this, and then my brain is going back to Glenn and the coffee shops. We're going to get back there. Drew, how do you feel about this notion of place?
Well, I mean, I've seen it. I've witnessed it. It was about 20 years ago that we jumped into this realm of recycling old buildings, and we opened up to the first tenants with drywallers and painters still in the hallways in November of 2003. And I can tell you this, in 2003, it was mostly young kids just out of college, just starting their first job. There were a few middle-aged and even older people, but mostly it was young kids. In the last 20 years, I would almost say it's flip-flop. There's probably more people in the Temple Building now my age, you know, in their 50s, 60s, 70s. And in fact, we've lost a few tenants, unfortunately, to death and to nursing homes. That's how much the demographics have changed. The other dramatic change is up until the last few years, very recently, would you see little children in the hallways, the lobby, the parking garage? Yeah, sure, once in a while, maybe there'd be a divorced couple, a dad would have his kid for the weekends. But in general, you didn't have family units living downtown at the Temple Building. Now I see little kids all the time with mom and dad, and it's just a complete change where you see everybody from, you know, my college-age kids to people older than I living downtown, and they love it. They love being near the theaters, the restaurants. I'll even give you another example. One of our long, long tenants, wonderful dentist, my dentist, I'll call him Dr. Mike. I might better not use his last name, but Dr. Mike has always been a country guy. He loves living out. In fact, he lives in my hometown of Mendon. But he worked downtown for decades as one of the few last city dentists. He and his wife, after raising their children, ended up loving downtown so much, they actually rented one of our units. It's a complete flip-flop of, you know, on the weekdays you work downtown and you go buy a cottage on Canandaigua Lake or out in the country to get away from it. Dr. Mike has done the opposite. He rents a unit from us. that he uses primarily with his wife and friends and children on the weekends, meaning on the weekends, instead of hanging out in horse country, he comes downtown to take in Jiva, to take in a play, to go to dinner. And so you're really seeing every demographic group now wanting to be downtown, from, you know, literally kids just out of college, their first job, right up to people in their 70s, 80s. And it's been a dramatic transformation in just 20 years down in this town.
I also think we turned some stereotypes on their head here. So when Glenn Kellogg points out that, you know, the notion of place not being important gets turned on its head when people show that they want the coffee shops, they want those downtown spaces. Here's another thing that gets turned on its head. One of the stereotypes of younger adults, teenagers all the way into millennial adulthood, is that, well, they're always on their phone. They're not talking to each other. What belies that, what goes right in the face of that, is the resurgence in the coffee shop experience, which is often younger adults talking face-to-face. It's not just people who are on their phones all the time. They actually want that, and it's usually downtown, face-to-face interactive space to meet, not just on their phones. In fact, we had a millennial on this program say, yeah, I'm on my phone until people show up. I'm usually texting, where are you? And then we sit down and we talk face-to-face. And when it comes to preservation, another stereotype may be that millennials, if all of the futurists were true, they're just using their own personal space, their own devices. They don't care about preservation. Research from the National Trust for Historic Preservation shows that more than 90% of millennials say that they support the concept of preservation. So, I mean, it's very easy, you know, for millennials to say yes to that, and you're nodding along with
that. Well, you know, Evan, a colleague of Larry and mine, Caitlin Mivas, created a young professionals group at the Landmark Society that they call themselves the YUPS, the Young Urban Preservationists. They do great work in the community. And I think that the 90%, I remember being in a meeting somewhere at the National Trust, and they shared the survey that you're referencing, the 90% of millennials support preservation. I don't disagree with that at all, and I don't question that number, because the survey, when conducted, really described what preservation really meant. It was this holistic approach to a resource. So we're not trying to simply preserve a building. I go back to my earlier comment. We're not looking at a building, and we're not preserving it just for the brick. We're preserving it because of the space it occupies and the jobs it creates and the community that it helps define, and the human interest that goes on within those walls. That's all part of it. Of course, the architecture for our organization is the primary concern, but it's not the only concern, by far the only concern. So I think that millennials, younger people in general, but as Drew points out, I think now it's even older people are starting to embrace that notion, that holistic view of community and neighborhood, and those numbers honestly don't surprise me.
Well, when Drew talks about, you tell those stories of people who want to be in the downtown space, all of these things that are happening, I want to ask all of you then, given that reality, what is the opportunity and what are some of the pitfalls that you might see in front of whether you're a developer, whether you're a preservationist, whether you're an urban planner, whatever the case may be? Given that reality, this resurgence in interest in downtown spaces, maybe historic spaces, places with character, the desire to be there, if not live there, and in some places, many cases, live there too, what are the opportunities in front of us, and what do you want to see either happen or change from your perspective, Drew?
Well, I think the opportunities are just huge, because you're literally seeing, I mean, in the last 10 years, you're seeing a complete recycling of old Class B and C buildings, and even some of the D buildings that would have been considered basket cases and just knocked down are being renovated because of this new trend. So the opportunities are just fantastic, and you're seeing now, I think we're getting very close to, you know, I've always heard Heidi Zimmermeyer, who's the guru in this area about urban living, say that, you know, once we hit 10,000 people living downtown, that's when you'll see the bodegas, the shoe stores, the sort of New York City or Philadelphia neighborhoods that we don't quite yet have. That
what's the number now downtown? Do we know?
I think we're up to about 9,000, 8,500. We're awfully close.
Heidi Zimmermeyer, the ubiquitous Heidi Zimmermeyer. Call the program, Heidi. Call your office, Heidi Zimmermeyer. But you think that number makes sense to you? Or
I
generally
do.
The concept?
Because I'm already seeing it. You're already seeing retail coming back, and that, you know, didn't exist back in 1986 when I started out at Midtown Tower as an associate. There just weren't. I mean, already then you were losing the 1950s.
Some people
character.
Think downtown retail is a pipe dream that should not be revived. That it's not realistic in modern.
Well, I will tell you this: it's a pipe dream if you try to force it through government incentive. It's got to work because it will work financially for the bodega owner, for the shoe repair guy, for the tailor. If it's not going to work off the numbers, meaning there's enough population of a certain income level to support it, then leave it alone. I think you can look at some of the huge amount of money that was put in the High Falls to sort of force a certain result. And it somewhat failed because the markets weren't quite ready to and capable of doing it. So I don't know for sure if Heidi's number of 10,000 is correct, but I think it's awfully close. It's in the strike zone. I know for a fact, mm-hmm. as you get more people downtown, whether it's 11, 12, 13,000, you will eventually see the retail come back because I've seen it with my own eyes. You see people downtown at, you know, sometimes 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock. It does, and we all see it during the jazz festival. But now you see people downtown in front of the Sibley building at almost all hours of night, up until 10, 11 o'clock. I'm very rarely downtown working that late, but you still see people out at the Liberty Pole talking. 20 years ago, you saw police officers and people that you probably wanted to have a police officer around when they were there. It's just completely changed. So I do think the opportunities are big. The only pitfalls, I think, is, again, you do have to have rules. You have to have level playing fields. And I don't think it should be something we expect the government, the city, the state to do. I think you've got to let private enterprise do it, let the developers. We've got some amazing developers in this town. You give them an opportunity to turn an old building into a new retail or a new mixed use, they'll do it. So I'm very excited about the opportunities for downtown Rush. I've witnessed the dramatic transformation in 20 years that I never would imagine could have come to fruition.
Okay. Glenn Kellogg?
I won't comment on there being a tipping point number because I'm not certain that there is. And when you look at other places, retail markets are a funny thing. And you can have communities with smaller downtown populations, but that downtown is still the center of their community. And that's still where the live Main Street is, and where there are still local shops. And it's also one of the things that no doubt retail is facing a huge change, certainly over the last decade, probably going to continue into the next decade. And it's particularly hit big box retailers who are turning and going online, that more of those things are online shopping. And then also in even larger and larger suburban formats. But one of the surprising trends that I think I've seen over the last couple of years, really the last couple of decades, is the surprising resilience and resurgence of historic Main Streets as centers for not big box retail. It's that experience that people want. And this comes back to things that we were talking about earlier, the experience of going in to those small local shops, give that place character and still remain popular. That's still a popular segment of retail around the country.
Where do you look in Rochester for echoes of that?
I think there's some of that on Park Avenue. I know that's a lot of restaurants. Incidentally, actually, a lot of retail is leaning more heavily towards restaurants. In fact, I think it was last year that we hit a shift in household spending where people were spending more on restaurants than they were on groceries, or it was something like that. But there's an increasing amount of household spending going to food away from home, and you're seeing that in our retail landscape.
Look at the South Wedge in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Dramatic. In fact, go back 30 years. You can't compare the South Wedge today with what it was like 30 years ago. It's a tale of two cities.
Okay, Wayne?
Well, I think in Rochester, we spoke earlier about the difference between the challenges in an urban setting versus a rural setting. But I think even if you look in the city of Rochester itself, not unlike any other city of its size, you can look and see pockets of opportunity, and then you can see pockets of areas that are just severely challenged. And unfortunately, a lot of that, I think, stems back to you know, the level and cycle of poverty in certain aspects of the city. So I think when we look at Rochester, though, in general, Rochester does a pretty good job of protecting its historic buildings. I'd like to think that we have a part to play in that at the Landmark Society. I think, though, that the challenge that we run up against, particularly in our preservation districts, I'll give East Avenue as an example. The East Avenue Preservation District, largely because of preservation's investment over the past 50 years in that district, has produced a district in our city that has really high returns, ripe for investment. And what concerns people like us is that because of that investment, now there's great opportunity for new construction, which then could potentially lead to demolitions. We haven't seen that here. And again, Rochester, the city of Rochester has been a good partner in really, I think, overseeing that process. What I think even more importantly we need to focus on is how to incentivize and invest really good projects in areas of the city that are ripe for growth and need investment. And we have plenty of those areas in the city.
Larry Francer.
I agree with what everyone has said about Rochester, and I want to point to the opportunities that are out there in the region. And I think, especially when you're getting out into the region, all of a sudden in these small villages and small towns and small cities, the opportunities are amazing because, of course, the cost of real estate is so much less. And if you look at what has taken place, and we bring it up every time that we're here, in the Genevas and in the Perrys, but as well in the Penyans, and also Dansville. Dansville has a very wonderful energy of young people moving back there and restoring their buildings and bringing a street life to it. And I think that's where a lot of the opportunity is.
All right, I want to grab, before he runs out of time, called in with a comment from Sparta. This is Hal. Go ahead, Hal.
Thank you for the discussion. I'm wanted to make a couple points related to the discussion in terms of suburbs and exurbs and rural areas like where I'm calling from. There's more and more development because of the lower price of a piece of land, and thus the unseen costs of this sprawl on both farmland, both the tax base, as rural districts pay maybe 10% for transportation in their school districts, compared to trying to develop incentives for reinvigorating urban areas in the city of Rochester that really could use that investment. So I haven't really heard a discussion of how to reinvigorate retail, as you know, a Sears person just told me that you know, someone had gone into the store and done all the research on an appliance and then bought it online, and this is reflected in this conversation that they're closing the Sears in Market View. In other words, I wonder if we might reflect more on having a school district that would be more countywide to raise the lower boats in terms of the school quality of education, as well as to try to reinvigorate rebuilding of neighborhoods so that what Mayor Johnson, which was the hook I shared with your operator, he said several years ago, quite a number of years ago, at a forum I was participating in at the First Unitarian Church on Witten Road, every house built in the exurbs or suburbs is an empty house in the city of Rochester. And it's not just that, but it's the educational, the cultural, the walkable communities, the low impact of using existing infrastructure. And out in the exurbs, many of these double wides that are built, it seems like, on every rural road every year, sometimes just go empty or forlorn. And yet that's valuable farmland or wilderness that's taken up. So I wonder if any of your guests could discuss this, and I'll take the conversation offline if that's all right.
All right. Yeah, thank you very much. Glenn Kellogg, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I'm really glad that you brought up the conversation about revitalizing historic neighborhoods. Not so much the retail side of it, but I think one of the one major planning and municipal problem that lots of cities like Rochester face are hundreds, thousands sometimes of houses that are derelict or in really bad condition in historic neighborhoods, in older historic, they may not be designated, but they're these older houses that contain some kind of charm and character, certainly more than maybe, not to characterize, but that your double wide might have. But there's a really difficult, it's really difficult for developers to address those neighborhoods where it's a neighborhood-wide problem, and you've got to take on, it's a developer isn't coming in and buying 12 acres. You're buying an eighth of an acre in one house at a time. This is where I'm going to put my plug in for the Incremental Development Alliance that I also happen to be the incoming chairman of the board for. The Incremental Development Alliance is actually trying to work on exactly this. And one of the initiatives we have is very close to preservation in this case, where we're trying to build an army of small developers who can help take on those neighborhoods and help fix those old houses. So we're trying to train community activists to, you want to change your neighborhood? Let me teach you how to buy that building and get it developed and run a pro forma and get it tenanted and bring that neighborhood back to life.
Do we need to talk about the Incremental Development Alliance on a separate program?
I'd love to.
Okay, because I think that that's probably merits its own conversation, but timely given the call here. Any other, Wayne?
Hal's point about the double wides and the housing and this rural conundrum that a lot of communities face. The one aspect I think that we try to get across is that we being the people of this region and community, we have the ability to frame our future however we would like for it to be framed. So we're in control of that. I think that the disinvestment, however, year after year, decade after decade, the loss of jobs, particularly in our rural communities, I think it almost leads to a sense, and sometimes with the elected officials, of a sense of desperation. We start trying to bring businesses in as quickly as we can because we're focused on tomorrow's bottom line. And to some degree, you can understand that and you can appreciate it. But desperation is never really a good foundation to make proper decisions for the long term. And so sometimes when we see a beautiful old historic building, it's designated, it's in good condition, it has plenty of viable reuses, we'll go on the tax rolls, create jobs, but then there's a plan for maybe demolishing that and putting in a gas station. That might be really alluring in the short term. The problem begins is when that gas station then is there for 5 to 8 years and it starts to look a little seedy and the people aren't getting paid much money and it doesn't become a catalytic project for the rest of the community to rally around and to develop around. So, good decision making I think is really important, and we have the powers of community to make good decisions.
All right, I'm way late for our only break. We're going to come back to more of your reaction. Got a couple of emails and phone calls to take here, so let's go ahead and get that only break of the hour, and we're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections, Governor Cuomo has a proposal to expand mobile sports betting in New York State, but somehow it's a proposal that seems to have angered everybody, from anti-gambling forces to those who want to engage in mobile sports betting. We'll discuss it first hour. Second hour, teaching history, helping historians do their work, and understanding the stories of local municipal history. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. As we talk about preservation, planning, and what CityLab says we can do better, got a lot of feedback in the next 10 minutes to get through, so let's move quickly. Doug in Churchville on the phone next. Go ahead, Doug.
Hi, my name is Doug Hill. I have lived most of my life in the Loy, New York. I noticed in some of the communities you mentioned where there's a revival and interest in historic preservation. I would just like to add that the Loy, New York is definitely one of those communities. Recent years, all of Main Street has gone on the historic, has become a historic site, National Historic Site. One of the Presbyterian Church got a National Historic Register. We have a few other houses, primarily in a cemetery, that are on it. And St. Mark's Episcopal Church in the Loy has been eligible for it, and we finally did our part in 2012 and asked for the Landmark Society to write our application for the National Historic Register. I just wanted to point out, and then I heard the word desperation, not maybe a good reason for historic restoration. And I wouldn't call St. Mark's Episcopal Church desperate, but we are a smaller congregation. We have spent on our endowment fund. The congregation is basically supporting the function of our church and its capital needs. And the Sacred Sites Foundation we've been in contact with. They're very interested in our building. And I know that it's a very long process to apply for the National Historic Register. And I understand ours is at the National Park Service. But I would just encourage you folks that have any pull at the national level to give our application as much and as quickly the attention it needs while we have a congregation to raise that half of a match for the Sacred Sites Foundation. I know that you folks probably know Leroy and know that it has many historic buildings, but if that one A.J. Warner architect stone church right there in the center of Leroy, if that were to close or were not to get the attention that it needs to its capital work, that would be a real poor impact on our community.
All right, Doug, thank you. I got to let you go because we got a lot to get through here. Some brief thoughts. Wayne Goodman, you want to take that from the Landmark Society?
I think that the work that Leroy is doing is great, and I think that the challenges surrounding Leroy are not unlike a lot of other sort of, you know, donut communities around Rochester. But the work is wonderful, and I think that they're approaching it the way they should. I think that authenticity of any community is important, and once we start peeling back authenticity, then we become any place USA. And how do you really promote? How do you promote your community when it looks exactly like every other community? So, I think that the Landmark Society is happy to work with Leroy. We've enjoyed it, and I don't know.
Good luck, and thank you for the phone call, Doug. Here's an email from Cassie, who writes about city density. Cassie says, the mantra that it is necessary and better to add density to the city is curious, because the city is already the densest part of the county. At this point, there needs to be concern for ensuring that the city continues to offer a diversity of living styles, from high density to single family. It is the suburbs that require redevelopment to correct the sprawl that exists. In the 50s to the 70s, the population turned away from city density living with the small lots and lack of green and car space. But everything is cyclical. The city offers not only density, but architectural interest and a variety of lifestyles within an historic setting. They can spoil what creates the desire to come back by removing too many regulations to allow more property conversion in the few remaining single-family neighborhoods into multiple-family houses, many of which are attracting people who have been living in the higher-density neighborhoods where they are tiring of the density but want to remain in the city. From Cassie. Agree, disagree there.
I think she's got a really good point.
I don't disagree either.
Right. Yeah.
She's got a really good point that you look at some of the neighborhoods right next to downtown on the east side, and it's hard to find a single family house. Single family houses that go on the market disappear very quickly, and because there's not that many of them, so many of them have been divided into apartments over the course of the last number of decades, and that's a difficulty. She's right that we need a diversity of housing. And we need to think about where single-family housing opportunity fits into the puzzle in Rochester.
Are we losing sight of that right now?
I'm not sure.
But it sounds like, at the very least, it's worth making sure it's still on the radar. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, okay, Cassie, sure. Thank you. Michael writes to us and says, one current trend at the intersection of development and preservation is the process called placemaking. As an activist, I've experienced small but important neighborhood-level successes under that banner. Placemaking is now given emphasis by developers. I prefer the more radical form, redesign of common public spaces by engendering grassroots participation, i.e. stakeholders as designers. And I would enjoy hearing your panelists' reaction and thought about the latter style of placemaking. So stakeholders as designers, or at least closely involved with processes here. Thoughts here?
Sure. I mean, charrettes have been around for many, many years, and they're still very, very popular, where you go into a neighborhood and you get all of the stakeholders, citizens and business owners, and look at your corridor and what is working and what isn't working, and everybody sits around, and you've got professionals that are doing some drawings for you. So I think it's a great process, and it's used very often here in Rochester.
If, though, to be fair, a charrette, not everyone who goes to a charrette, I think 80 to 120 people went out to the charrette not too long ago. Not every single idea is going to be put into play, but the community can't feel like, oh, you threw us a bone, now go away. You know, there has to be some actual response to the stakeholders, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough?
Sure.
Okay.
I think it has to be a sincere process.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're saying. Yeah.
I do think that, the charrettes, and I think the public involvement and the focus, particularly on placemaking, I think, is an arena of which preservation is a big component of. And that's more of, I think, what we all four were discussing early in the program, where I think the Landmark Society and preservationists in general have been moving, and we need to continue to move to look at our historic resources in a more holistic view. And that seems to really oftentimes fall within the realm of placemaking.
I think the caller has a very good point. I'll point you to our experience, our second large experience with renovating old buildings is Station 55 and the public market. One of the things that got us attracted to putting a lot of our own money into it, because the banks were not interested back in 2004 of putting $3-4 million into a beat up old industrial building in a relatively rough neighborhood. But we became intrigued kind of as a partnership between the city of Rochester, who was willing to put money into the public market to fix it up, renovate it, and also the Market View Heights Neighborhood Association, a very excellent group of neighbors and business owners who put the requisite political pressure on the city that we didn't have alone as one developer on a empty, lonely street. And they were instrumental in, I think, persuading the city to make some basic upgrades to the public market. And, I mean, you look at what's happened to that neighborhood, Railroad Street specifically, in the last 10, 15 years,
stemming primarily from the upgrades to the public market, and it's just dramatic. I mean, my kids go to beg my wife take her down a drive from Mendon to go to the public market on Saturday. You've seen not only all of Railroad Street become renovated, and go to try find an empty building on Railroad Street, good luck. But the really cool, sexy, kind of exciting part is the gentrification that's been kicked off by Market View Heights and the renovation of Railroad Street. You're seeing all those single and two-family houses for blocks in every direction, all getting renovated, fixed up, and it's happening naturally. Nobody's doing
it. We got to spend a whole other hour on how you use the word gentrification. Did you use it as a positive?
A positive.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's not the G word. Displacement is the D word.
So you're trying to reclaim the word gentrification as a positive.
Sure. Absolutely.
Displacement as a negative.
But I think that...
guys, you should have done this like half an hour ago so I could mine this territory. Literally, the show music's going to run and the whole audience is going,
oh, no.
What happened with gentrification? We changed the connotation entirely?
Well, I think... No, I think that in this case, with that particular district... it goes back to the point I made earlier about balancing. We need to look at areas of opportunity. Investment needs to be placed where it's most needed. And economic results will follow.
All right, Larry Francer. That's our next conversation. Gentrification, okay. Re-understanding it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Was not ready for that. Thanks a lot. That's a whole lot. Larry Francer and Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society. Exactly.
Sorry, guys.
Wayne and Larry from the Landmark
Society. I guess we're coming back soon.
Larry, Wayne, thanks for nothing. I appreciate it. Drew Costanzo at Costanza Enterprises. Nice having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn Kellogg with Urban Advisors, Hearts Local Grocers, and the Incremental Development Alliance, which we'll talk about separately as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
All right. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.